And welcome, 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 dear listeners. Good morning, good morning, good morning on this lovely Sunday. Well, it is coolish. You obviously can't see any loveliness in it. And just before I can actually commence with the rest of my greeting, we've got to go for a short ad break, dear listeners, and we're going to come back right after that, heading into the rest of that greeting. Enjoy the rest of your morning.
Great news. Input just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of IMBA? Get all exclusive features for just $36 Namibian a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything IMBA has to offer at an unbeatable price. IMBA, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Now, coming back there from the ad break, dear listeners, once again, let's start our greeting over. Well, in terms of obviously looking at the morning so far, I know, it's still deprived of some light. So obviously we don't know how good the morning particularly is, but nonetheless, if you've woken up just now or a little bit earlier, good morning. Welcome to my Sunday morning take, and you're in my company all the way from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m. Our talk this morning, dear listeners, gets us into a interesting development, which is actually based upon one of Namibia's largest development partners, the European Union. Actually celebrating yesterday, the 1st of November, its founding. The founding particularly was actually something a lot longer in the pipeline, because you can trace it as far back as 1909, specifically where the first particular sort of like collaborative treaties and agreements were signed. The first of that being a one between the United Kingdom and France. And it was literally even known as the Anglo-France treaty to its extent. And it was a sort of like a precursor agreement that laid the foundation for anything else to happen, because it flowed, from 1904, not 1909, from 1904. So it started even earlier. And the aspect or the conditions primarily for our discussion this morning is how everything came about specifically that gave birth, that allowed for this particular collection and collective of countries, 27 countries to be exact, to become this particular sort of like unified force, and how long it also took them in terms of these particular negotiations and the like. As we know, in the African context, dear listeners, and this is the particular analysis that I've cited and highlighted, it seems that on the AU platform, we are doing everything backwards to front. We joined the particular, we are part of an AU exercise where we all are members, that we are joining for political, you know, involvement more than economic integration involvement. Although on the AU side of things, it is in the works. It actually has been in the foundational treaty or the foundational agreement to the AU, and that treaty was inherited from the OAU, the first format or the first notion of the African Union. And in that particular scenario, there were a lot of countries that still were not independent at that stage, but then obviously with the AU platform, many of those particular countries had achieved their independence from a previous particular colonial, if you can call them, statuses that they had, or that they were under, or that they occupied. Now, the reason why I'm citing that particular backwards to front discussion is that the European Union in its own right obviously has its particular roots, because it's similar. I mean, it's 1 year younger than us as Namibia. The celebration is technically on the 1st of November 1993. And the particular celebration actually started with four sort of like starter members. If you can call them starter members, because they were literally like the first four countries to sign the particular agreement. This was Belgium, Denmark, Germany, and Greece. Now, I'm pretty surprised with Greece itself, primarily to be one of the founding signatories to the European Union. I'll give you a little bit of a backstory, but like back in 2013, between 2011 to 2013, Greece was facing a lot of particular, headwinds, and the headwinds were primarily based upon the 2008 to 2009 financial crash. It's also mentioned specifically in our literature review, is that Greece was facing a lot of particular financial pressure, primarily because a lot of the financial crash had flooded over into Greece itself. And so too Greek banks, as well as also the Greek government, were trying to, you know, they were trying to steady the boat. They were trying to just find the particular, you know, level plane, if you can call it that, or they wanted to reach a specific plateau of stability, or more of a scenario of, you know, trying to just achieve a positive footing so as to then work from that. And much of it was based upon the ability for the country to access financing from the European Central Bank, the ECB, and that the European Central Bank was literally based upon what funding it could get from the German banking society, or the German economy for that matter. So it made things pretty precarious for Greece. Greece's finance minister, who stepped in 2015, he says it's 2015, but I think I saw him in 2013, Yanis Varoufakis. If you don't know who he is, he's also one of the particular economists that I personally like. Even though he's now a lot more political, because he's now, he's got a political cross-European, or pan-European, political party. Why do I say that? Is primarily, you know, they've been championing, this particular exercise that'll come up in this week, known as social justice, in the European realm, and it is based upon a notion of not investing in public services and other public and other public infrastructure aspects, but rather continuing that particular investment level, and to ensure that technically people still have futures, you know, and still have access to facilities. And primarily also dealing with a lot of the anti-immigrant sentiment that is now found in the European context. Anti-immigration is also a heavy thing, primarily because there's a lot of what you would call right-wingers or ultra-conservative. But the downside is, guys, you also find conservatives here in Africa and across the continent itself. And specifically, these particular conservatives are people that, you know, they are family members, or they are families, you know, it's basic stuff. They are part of households. They're married people. They believe in certain particular values, and those values are multiplied across the country, because it's not just one person espousing it. You can literally see it as a template. So, the foundational treaty technically that forms part of the celebration for 1 November of the European Union's founding is known as the Treaty of Maastricht. Now, Maastricht is found in the Netherlands. And this particular town or city known as Maastricht obviously hosted the particular signing signing event whereby the first foundations were laid for the EU. Now, don't get me wrong, guys. There was a precursor document or precursor agreement that existed before the Treaty of Maastricht, that actually brought into effect the Treaty of Maastricht. Now, the reason why I'm citing and gave you that sort of like comparison between what we are doing on the AU platform and what has been seen to be working on the European platform is that the European platform has started from defensive treaties like military treaties and protective treaties and the likes between European countries. And then it transitioned into various particular, you know, they first start with that first step because obviously at that particular time, 1904, everybody was warlike and everybody was looking to each other to, you know, have their next bust up based upon either a border, based upon either just purely testing out their latest machinery or, you know, just having a grudge, a political grudge at a specific political time in the European context. So, yeah, those things happen, guys. Don't worry. So the Treaty of Maastricht itself is something that started the whole process as we know it today in 1993, but actually it was signed a year earlier on 7 February 1992. The particular treaty obviously also is viewed as the foundation treaty of the European Union, obviously being concluded in 1992 between then 12 member states of the European communities. It announced a new stage in the process of European integration. Now, this particular European integration chiefly cited the particular provisions for a shared European citizenship, firstly, for the eventual introduction of a single currency, second, and for a common foreign and security policy, third, and that a number of changes to the European institutions and their decision-making procedures, as well as also, not least, a strengthening of the part of the powers of the European Parliament and a more majority voting on the Council of Ministers. So here's what it also translated to. You see, if you guys look at this, like the Pan-African Parliament of Namibia, that Namibia is also part of, that is the AU's other particular functionary tool or instrument, is that I've noticed that in the Pan-African scenario, the Pan-African Parliament scenario, is that you don't vote for your MPs, us, our Namibian MPs, to be there. You actually vote in your local vote, and when that MP or that political party is able to reach the Namibian National Assembly, it's sort of like they designate there between themselves who attends this particular platform. Now, last time I've checked, it's like 3 people that attend it. And it works on an annual basis of like a rotational scenario. So they take each of the political parties in Namibia's National Assembly, those that have got the largest seating, and people are sent. Every year it's a new trio or new quintet, no? Quartet. Quintet would have been 5, or a quartet of people. And it's a rotating situation like that. But it's forever like the 3 largest or the 3 largest seat owners in, you know, the guys with the largest seats in our National Assembly, they send these 3 MPs to be part of the Pan-African Parliament. However, in the European context, you actually vote for your MPs. If you find yourself in Spain, you can vote for an MP in the EU or the European Parliament. Or if your MP is locally, a Spanish one, and you're in Spain, you vote for that person to be in the parliament, because that person has to promote, you know, a representation of, let's say, a Portuguese or Spanish voice to the European Parliament, to be at the European Parliament. So you get scenarios like that, for example, where people actually vote for their, you know, representatives to go and sit in the European Parliament and to debate issues as well as also represent specific interests from the various countries that they come from. Now, if you see the two contrasts that I just cited there to you, it makes things also a little bit weird because primarily, we don't know ultimately what particular powers the Pan-African Parliament actually has. Because in many cases, much of the developments are coming through from the Heads of State Commission. But before that, ad break.
Democracy is not a spectator sport. It is a participatory event. The essence of democracy is in your participation. Therefore, make sure that you participate by electing your representatives in the Regional Council and Local Authority elections on 26 November 2025. Democracy starts with you. Preserve it by getting involved. Go vote. Your vote is your voice.
You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday.
Thank you.
And just like that, we heard the sounds there of Santana with the song Oye Como Va, and ultimately bringing up to you, which is, you know, we're about 25 minutes out from the top of the hour at 6 a.m. Now, where we left off is obviously that the particular scenarios you obviously see that I've laid out to you just before the break and the musical break has been a scenario of the backwards to front illustration that I sometimes, that I've observed in the African context versus the European platform or the European template that works. Now, although these particular developments, obviously, that's now the shared European citizenship, the shared European economic integration, the common foreign and security policies development and establishment of the European Parliament. Although all these were seen by many to be sort of like a straightforward development towards a federal Europe, key areas remained intergovernmental, with national governments collectively taking key decisions. Now, this particular constitutional debate, obviously, continued through the negotiation of some treaties or subsequent treaties that culminated in the 2007 Treaty of Lisbon. Now, that 2007 Treaty of Lisbon, which obviously has to cite to you that, you know, there were a whole bunch of other countries that obviously also agreed to the Maastricht Agreement, and they just continued flowing on from there. The Treaty of Lisbon itself was an agreement that amended two treaties which formed the constitutional basis of the European Union. That particular Treaty of Lisbon, which was signed by all EU member states on 13 December 2007, entered into force on 1 December 2009. Now, the Treaty of Lisbon was also preceded by the Treaty of Nice, and the Treaty of Nice was preceded by the Treaty of Amsterdam, and right after Maastricht, 1 November 1993, because Maastricht was, remember, signed in 1992, another treaty known as the Edinburgh Agreement was also signed in 1992. The Edinburgh Agreement, just to give you a little bit of an small overview, is also known as the Edinburgh Decision, and it was an agreement that was reached at a European Council meeting in Edinburgh, Scotland, that granted Denmark 4 exceptions to the Maastricht Treaty. So that it could be ratified by Denmark itself. So the ratification, remember guys, what the term ratification also implies or means is technically, is I agree in principle. I don't agree to the whole thing as it stands there. I just like the way, and I like the way it sounds, so specifically the agreement. So I like the agreement. Not to say I agree to every word of the agreement, I just like the agreement. Now, obviously, ratification has been one of the biggest talking points that obviously has taken place on the AU platform, primarily with the AfCFTA, because it's not that the member states of the AU completely agreed to the word verbatim, every particular thing found in that AfCFTA agreement, and it's a notion of everyone just agreeing in principle to this particular treaty. Now, when you have to look at certain agreements obviously playing particular roles in what they do or in the specific kinds of memberships that each member nation has, for example, you see something like Denmark's particular amendment being applied or being processed through, it highlights to you specifically why certain countries also still have their national currencies, as well as also certain particular aspects still intact, whereas in other European countries you would go and find, oh, so their central bank doesn't technically exist anymore. And when you see these particular developments, or you see that certain countries still have their currencies, and then you understand there must be like a cross-value mitigation factor that assists that currency from that country in relation with the European, the European Union's own euro, the currency itself, and how decisions are made in line in terms of these relationships that are present. Now, all of this obviously speaks towards how you continuously need to have everyone's interests at stake. Everyone's interests obviously being all member states and affiliated nations, because the European Union is also known as for having its particular affiliates with countries like Turkey, the other Scandinavian countries like Norway, Sweden, and Finland, and how they primarily also factor in terms of the trade between those countries and the specific bloc. The other treaties that I mentioned, for example, like the Treaty of Amsterdam, which officially is known as the Treaty of Amsterdam that amends the Treaty of the European Union, which technically is the Treaty of Maastricht, is that the treaties establishing the European communities and certain related acts is also, the full name of the Treaty of Amsterdam. And that one itself is just as sort of like, it pushes everything forward in terms of the developments that took place on the 1st of December 2000. So if you don't know what happened on the 1st of December 2000, it's specifically that the European Union actually formally got formed on that day, and specifically just a couple of months or half a year. It's actually a year to half a month to half 1.5 year later. The euro and the central European Central Bank was launched as well, which gave rise obviously to this integrated single market notion through those particular two instruments coming to fruition. Now, in the wake of the Eurozone debt crisis that unfolded from 2009, the most enduring reference to the Maastricht Treaty had been the rules of compliance, meaning the Maastricht criteria. And this is primarily aimed at the currency union. Now, the Maastricht criteria is the Euro convergence criteria, which are the criteria for the European Union member states that are required to meet in order to enter the third stage of the economic and monetary union. And that's ultimately what this bloc is. And also to adopt the euro as their current currency. Now, the four main criteria, which actually comprise of five criteria each, is pretty central to these particular notions. Now, they are also based in the European Union's founding constitution, in the following article of Article 140, which actually lays down the functioning of the EU itself. Now, you have also various particular relationships that exist within that particular bloc. For example, that they have something known as microstates. Microstates are, for example, countries that technically in some cases don't exist. In other cases, they do exist. Why do I say technically and technically not? For example, a country like the Vatican City, which is known as the world's smallest country, and also the world's smallest city, has a UN member status. If you guys did not know that, the Vatican City, it has a UN member status because it's a UN member. And it obviously is based within the capital city of Italy, that being Rome. However, they themselves, specifically, they obviously have particular sort of like position within the European context. But when you get to the other microstates like San Marino, Andorra, and Monaco, because one of the weirdest things is, I saw something about Monaco just recently in this past week, and I was like, but this thing is not actually a country. It's not actually a country, Monaco. It's technically not a country. Why? Because it's part of the French state. It's part of France. You don't see a part of France being cut off from itself and acting autonomously. You don't see that on any particular illustration of any particular map and the sorts. It just doesn't exist. However, Monaco is viewed as a microstate like Andorra and like San Marino. And it is cited even here that they, specifically, they are not full-on members of the EU, but they have signed monetary agreements with the EU, which allow them to officially adopt the euro, the currency, and issue their own variant of euro coins. Now, these states had all previously used one of the eurozone currencies replaced by the euro, or a currency that was pegged to one of these particular aspects. These states, these microstates, are not members of the eurozone and do not get a seat at the European Central Bank, or, as it is sometimes known, as the Eurogroup. Another particular criteria is obviously the Stability and Growth Pact. This is as European member states have to adhere to this particular criteria found within the treaty. The Stability and Growth Pact is an agreement among all 27 member states that facilitates and aims to maintain the stability of the European, of the Economic and Monetary Union of the EU. And it's primarily based on the articles of 121 and 126 of the EU itself. And it serves as a framework to serve price stability and fiscal responsibility. And it was also adopted with identical limits for governments, the governments that signed on, the member states, for their budget deficits and for their debts as the convergence criteria. And this is as several countries did not exercise a sufficient level of fiscal responsibility during the first 10 years of the European Union's lifetime. This is obviously as two major Stability and Growth Pact reforms were subsequently introduced as well. Now, you obviously also had the first reform, which was the Six Pack, which entered into force on December 2011, and was followed on by January 2013's amendment, with the more ambitious Fiscal Compact, which was signed by 25 out of the 27 member states. Now, you can obviously see the intricacies of the financial part of, or let's rather call it sort of like the economic part of the European Union, because this is obviously as strict measures were put in order to guide member states and to maintain the integrity of the currency and the central bank itself. Now, the European Union and much of the treaties that they signed, and this has been something that I've cited sort of like lightly in various talking points across the years, specifically since 2021, that the EU's obviously started with, at its core, since after the Second World War, to head toward this more integrated European bloc or European project, which was aimed specifically at empowering economic integration and empowering if you can call it good neighborliness, for that matter. Now, good neighborliness, dear listeners, it's a very difficult thing sometimes to achieve. Now, I have cited so many times here in the African context why good neighborliness is a bit of an issue. Why it is an issue? Well, it's straightforward. In many cases, how we as Africans primarily fail our particular integrated African project is that we don't wish to trade much with each other. But we love trading outside of the continent. The idea here has been that for way too long, or for far too long, we prefer other foreign currencies dominating our currency's particular value, and we prefer sending raw materials or semi-processed materials off the continent, and we'd like those monies. It's one of the things that why I kept saying during the course of this week, the continent is only known for its three particular core values. Well, not core values, but rather core offerings. Cheap labor, cheap land, and cheap materials. That's all we are known for. We can't even amend these particular perspectives, except for South Africa, primarily because we have a great issue specifically in connecting, first and foremost, our education systems to our economic landscape. Now, when you view much of these particular things, obviously, you get to understand why, on the African context, we worked backwards to front. We worked from a political position. We still have to sort out that particular political position because we supposedly had a silencing of the guns project, which was supposed to end in 2020, and a whole bunch of military dictatorships step up. And one of them obviously created one of the biggest headaches this past week. Actually two. Specifically the one in Burkina Faso with that Traore colonel guy that was trained by the Americans and trained by the French as well, and who decided, you know what, I'll kick them out of the country. But in many cases, things predictably went as I predictably expected them to go for Burkina Faso. If you guys did not know what happened in this past week, he actually dissolved their electoral commission using the words that it is a major waste of money. Now, when an unelected individual who becomes your president, I say unelected individual who becomes a president of a country, decides to dissolve an electoral commission, you just have to sit there asking yourself, so this technically means that this guy's usurping power. Well, he did already usurp the power. If you guys don't remember how Traore became president, or leader of Burkina Faso, is specifically an election took place, and when the ruling party in Burkina Faso won the elections again, he decided to take over. So he was waiting to see whether or not something would be confirmed and whether the same particular people would be in charge in terms of administering the country and its interests and its values. And if he didn't like the result, he'd step in and change things by force, which he did. Remember, all those politicians are in jail, if you guys do not know this. So that particular template obviously cites to you that military dictatorship does not work in the interest of even, let's rather call it what it is, you know, the lesser fortunates in the society of a nation. It doesn't. It doesn't change anything. Madagascar is another template of such a particular development, specifically with many of the protesters in Madagascar saying that they didn't ask an army captain in Madagascar to become head of state. He installed himself as head of state. He was opportunistic. He was opportunistic. In 2025, you still have, unfortunately, some of our African member states to the AU who decide that it's the best way to go about doing things is to literally solve this by your local army intervening. But it's literally just your local army wishing to be corrupt. That's it. Now, the reason why I'm citing that particular point of view is primarily that you can potentially see the African project or the Pan-African project crumbling a little bit. You can see it. There's nothing wrong, guys, with being impressed by someone else's endeavors, because you actually realize that there's something you can do that can be similar to what they do. The particular treaty of Maastricht itself was one in many treaties that the European member states had signed with each other specifically to achieve the 1992-1993 level itself. Because to reach that 1992-1993 level actually is the sort of like the springboard, the foundation for everything else that came afterwards. Within seven to nine years, they rolled out a currency and they actually rolled out a central bank and they rolled out a common trading block and they rolled out a representation entity that now factors in as a, almost acts like a country, because here in Namibia you can see it, there's an EU embassy, but you still have individual European representation in Namibia. For example, there's a German embassy, there's a French embassy, there's a Spanish embassy, there's a Portuguese embassy, there's a Finnish embassy. So, you know, you see still that in essence, there is sort of like this uniformity discussion being dealt with, which is also, which also feeds into the observation that William Ruto made last year at the Italy-Africa summit that was hosted last year in Rome. Was Ruto said, why can't the AU speak on behalf of all 54 countries? Why can't the AU achieve the level such as what the European Union had achieved? Just on Friday's particular discussion of the home run, where I spoke about the entertainment and media landscape or economy or industry in Africa, that particular report focused on three of Africa's largest economies, which was Kenya, Nigeria, and South Africa. All three of them obviously were former British colonies. Yeah, that's a reality. But all three of them also contained potentially the three largest entertainment industries on the continent, with the three largest growing trends being observed. And all three of these particular current countries provide the stabilities for such particular developments to take place. Now I ask you, dear listeners, when you obviously see these particular developments in each of these three countries, yes, they've had their own sort of like growth pains. Nigeria itself has gone through dictatorships as well. Kenya was sort of like, yeah, they were like political dynasties. If you don't know what a political dynasty is, it's like you had the same sort of like revolving door system of the three main politicians just dominating the Kenyan political landscape. Election cycle in, election cycle out. And then you obviously come to South Africa, which has shown itself to be highly resilient, achieved highly industrial levels through internal policies, but on many cases also has been the bad guy on the African continent for its particular history back then, you know, pre-1994. But that history of pre-1994 for South Africa itself was also where South Africa had to identify itself in terms of whether it wanted to be sort of like the first template of what Namibia currently is, or whether it wanted to achieve its own industrialization. I discovered that in the 1950s, South Africa had to take a radical step. Yes, even as bad as it sounds, they had to industrialize. They were in the 1950s where we are today. We took an ad break.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. As jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet, kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world.
Changed. I lost my vision, but I'm coming of age now. Well, at some stage, I changed my mind over a bottle of cheap wine. I'll fix myself up when the moment's right. Just not tonight. Say a prayer into my drink. I think about you more than I should. Would I fade into the solar system if I left my neighborhood? Stay now. I was looking for a real soft landing. Hey now. All I wanted was some understanding. Cause I don't wanna work the room tonight. I just wanna be by your side when it all unfolds. When it all unfolds, I know that we weren't always on the same page. Well, I guess the truth is I was bruised in the first place. From the first day. If I let down my guard now. Well, I don't wanna get my hopes up every time I get too close. I'm trying to shape my tunnel vision, cause I think about you more than I should. Fade into the solar system if I could. If I could stay now. I was looking for a real soft landing. Hey now. All I wanna was some understanding. Cause I don't wanna work the room tonight. I just wanna be by your side when it all unfolds. When it all unfolds. Say a prayer into my drink. I think about you more than I should. Would I fade into the solar system if I left my neighborhood? I think about you more than I should.
So we come back there from the sounds of St. Raymond with just having passed the midway point of this morning session of My Sunday Morning Take. Yes, the light is out. Specifically, you can see the sort of like the break of dawn coming about. And if you have just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning, dear listeners. As well as also, you're in the company of myself, Dwight, here on the Sunday Morning Take. Every Sunday morning on Eagle FM, your number one talk radio station. Where we left off primarily, I was talking about the precursor developments and some of the things that you would have seen or heard or read of about African, each African country's particular developmental pathway and the likes. Now, our particular problem is that, and you can see it pretty clearly, is that we have to identify which particular organs of the AU have to govern over the individual states, the 54 states. However, we leave everything up to a select club of the heads of government, the heads of state, a particular realm. Whereas in the European context, you've got a whole bunch of other of integrated systems and structures that actually provide strength to each other. It's sort of like a spider's web, but they're all intertwined with each other, all these particular treaties and developments. And they all specifically aim to achieve certain particular goals. But before I actually continue, let's get this caller coming through. Eagle FM. Okay, I see it's a missed call right there. Now, the Maastricht Treaty and the Maastricht Criteria obviously speak towards what countries have to finalize and what countries have to achieve. Against the backdrop of the end of the Cold War, which obviously ended in 1989, and the reunification of Germany, and also you had to look at the anticipation of accelerated globalization across the world, the treaty negotiated tensions between member states seeking deeper integration and those wishing to retain greater national control. So, it was still a notion of individual identity for each of the states, as well as also being integrated into a bigger project. Now, individual identity and integration into a bigger project is also some of the things that you see not happening on the African continent. You have seen some African states subscribing to the AU's particular development project, which is the integrated infrastructure, the potential economic integration, which is the AfCFTA's bedrock, or where the AfCFTA serves as a bedrock to that, and the integrated transport networks and systems across the continent. But in many cases, the question in terms of asking, have we achieved some sort of satisfactory levels of progression, is not being answered. It's not being asked as well. Instead, we've also tried to look at how to deal with certain particular problematic areas in Africa's history itself. Said particular problematic areas has culminated in the theme for this 2025, which is the AU's theme of seeking reparations, whereby also in this past week, if you've read Friday's The Villager e-paper platform, the recent media engagement by the Chinese embassy with Namibian media has cited and stated that, they also stand in solidarity and in support of this particular endeavor by African and Latin American countries. Now, you should obviously see this as a particular scenario in terms of, okay, so we are still stuck with certain particular lingering negative developments. To us, it's positive. But when you look at the broader scheme of things, it shows a negativity approach or negative approach towards the discussion, because you can clearly see that there is no end in sight to this particular process. There's also no sort of like concrete progression mechanism to say, you know, there was this particular event was held and these particular statistics were shared and these particular insights. You don't see that. Even in the Namibian context, guys. The last time I spoke about anything regarding Namibia's particular genocide developments in the country was at the start of this year, after the vice president, that being Vice President Lucia Witbooi, had attended a particular engagement here at the Hilton Hotel, which was a discussion hosted by civil society organizations based upon, and the main theme, because it was a 2-day event, was the vice president speaking regarding, you know, women in the seeking reparations for the various things across the African continent that have happened here. I'll tell you now, between then, January, and now, November, I've only seen two particular events that has translated to some sort of a public platform of engagement. There's only been 3 or 2.5 events or developments potentially of something in terms of showing interactions between the two sides, that meaning the victims and the perpetrators of that historic crime. But further on, like national projects, continental project-wise, I can convincingly tell you today, zero. Not even on an AU level. Because on the AU level, they've currently been discussing things, for example, like the integrated infrastructure developments, as well as also trying to integrate the African continent a lot closer. But we see more conferences rather than we see more concrete treaties, for example, like these particular developments that the European Union is based on. Now, the founding European countries for the European Union, those founding nations, resolved to continue the process of creating an even closer union among the people of Europe. That's literally encompassed in the Treaty of Maastricht. Now, the treaty's purposes, or the treaty proposed that further steps had to be taken in order to advance European integration under 7 titles. The first title, Common Provisions, established the European Union on the foundation of the 3 already partially merged European communities. So they already existed pre-1992. You had the European Economic Community, the WEC. The WEC was a particular treaty that lasted, I think, from the 1970s into the 1980s. And it was the latest form at that stage of European integration from the Common Market Area, or the European Common Market Area. It was a precursor agreement before that as well, that stemmed from 1950-something, whereby European countries agreed to become this integrated trading mechanism where they decided to trade more with each other as opposed to exporting their finished goods and products. And obviously before that, they had their reconstruction period from 1948 or 1947, one of the 2 years, after the Second World War, leading into that particular development. Now, the 3 already existing treaties or phases or aspects that they had pre-1992 was the European Economic Community, the European Coal and Steel Community, and the European Atomic Energy Community. The treaty itself, confirmed among its objectives, are the introduction of a citizenship of the Union, and also a notion of economic and monetary union, which ultimately included a single currency, and lastly, a common foreign and security policy that included an eventual framing of a common defense. But before we continue, we take another short break.
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just $36 Namibian a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
So Now, coming back there from the short break, and just where we left off, dear listeners, three particular provisions had to be met specifically during the course of the Maastricht Treaty's particular signing or formulation, and ultimately these things had to be agreed upon. Now, common citizenship is a particular thing that's also on the cards in an African context for the AU. The Europeans have already achieved this particular thing. You can, in many cases, you just need your ID, or you sometimes just buy a ticket and then you cross over. In other scenarios, it's a question of potentially just being able to register yourself, you know, on both sides of the border, and then you can move in and out as much as you can. I'll tell you today this, and it'll become a big problem in future on an African continent scenario. We will have big issues, specifically for Southern Africa, regarding such an approach to immigration or a common citizenship discussion. Why? In many cases, dear listeners, other African countries actually do not have proper border controls or proper border management systems in place. And we do. We, specifically Namibia. We also have those systems in place primarily because we actually protect the Namibian environment. Now, our Namibian environment protections or mechanisms for protection can't extend past the border, because that means it's another country that you're stepping into. And it's up to other countries that have to play their significant part. Namibia forms part of a very lovely particular project known as CASA, or, yeah, CASA. No? This is CASA. But it literally incorporates Namibia, Angola, Zambia, and I think Botswana to the east. And it has to do literally with the environmental management of animal species and plant species in that specific territory, that specific zone that crosses over four borders. Pretty awesome in terms of resource management. Pretty awesome in terms of environmental management. The question still exists is, does it also play a particular role in human communities on the ground and rural development management as well? Does it? You don't hear much about it because it's contained specifically just in an environmental scope. On the ground, for things to work, you obviously need the human to implement the particular projects. We step in from that particular indication into the next one, which is based upon the single currency approach. For now, the European Union, or the Euro, it's as it's known, the currency, is obviously known as one of the big four trading currencies in the world, which is also recognized as one of the big four international currencies. It gets traded a lot, and it gets used and adopted in many particular transactions across the world, just like the US dollar. The US dollar has depreciated in value in recent months and weeks. You now pay for one US dollar 16 Namibian dollars. It's a far cry from the 19 and 20 US dollar and 20 Namibian dollar mark at the start of this year and at the end of last year. But the euro still stands at above the 20 Namibian dollar mark for 1 euro. They still stand there. So, which obviously has to highlight to you that policies, regulations are actually positive and feeding into a positive sentiment around the currency itself. Now, as mentioned, the seven titles that obviously are looked at in terms of advancing European integration that formed part of the Maastricht Treaty, which actually came into effect on the 1st of November, 1993, is that with Title 2, provisions that looked at the amending of the treaty establishing the European Economic Community, that also aimed at reformulating the EEC, which is the European Economic Community, as the central pillar of the Union. Now, this particular title amends the EEC's Treaty of Rome Constitution, renaming it to the European Community to reflect the Union's broader ambition. As mentioned, they've had multiple treaties that aim to advance the next step. You know, this treaty laid down commitments, and then after achieving those commitments, you then advance it to the next level. So the amendments also incorporated, which detail, you know, various particular protocols associated to it, a stage progression, meaning you have to work in phases or in stages, towards monetary union, which included the price stability first criteria for adoption of a single currency and for the operations of the prospective European Central Bank. Other amendments created the Office of the European Ombudsman, expanded the structural fund assistance to the poorer European Union regions, and also helped to broaden community competencies in education, culture, public health, consumer protection, trans-European networks, and industry and the environment. Now, in these and the other particular areas which did not fall within the community's exclusive competence, in accordance with the principle of subsidiarity, subsidiarity action, which was to be taken only if, by reason of scale or effects, the objectives cannot be more efficiently achieved by member states themselves. Which primarily also speaks towards, you know, the particular actions that the community wishes to take. Now, when you have to look at the actions that the communities use, would like to take, it's based upon a scenario of, okay, so what can you try to correct? What can you try to improve? If it's something like, for example, what recently popped up in the past 10 years in everyday European developments, it obviously has been mass immigration or mass migration from Central Asia, or let's say here from the Middle East to the European countries. And then also now subsequently in recent years from Africa to the European countries. And this has led specifically to many member states. Ultimately, I say many, not all, many, implementing hard border control mechanisms. In many cases, they just had borders where you can literally just walk over in Europe. This has obviously seen countries like Hungary, countries like Poland, countries like, there's another one that I'm forgetting. Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia establishing, they literally went and reinforced their borders. Primarily because so many migrants were moving through certain countries like Turkey, in some cases through Russia, to literally get to Europe. And then they went like, whoa, this is a bit much. This is a bit much. Now, obviously, one of the accusations that exists is that, for example, countries like Finland and Poland were accusing Russia of channeling a lot of these migrants that were coming to them from the Middle East to these borders to try and sort of like destabilize these countries with this particular sort of like chaotic migration trend. The downside has been, this has been a development that has been there for so long. It's a little bit weird to say, you know, that Russia is doing anything nefarious. It's a little bit weird. Because in many cases, which has also been proven just recently by one of the news outlets in the UK, is that they went literally to France to go and ask African migrants why they are, what their destination is, or would like to be, and why that destination. And one of these guys, I kid you not, guys, it's a little bit of a comedic scenario. One of these guys literally stopped a migrant from, was it from Mali or from Senegal? And the guy could speak. It's a young man. He could speak English. He asked the guy, because you have this wide shot and you see these migrants that are just walking past this camera crew. And the guy asked the migrant, you know, what's your destination? Where are you going? And the guy said, well, I'm trying to reach the UK. And then he asked, okay, why are you trying to reach the UK? And he said, well, specifically because, the language, because I can speak English and I'd like to work there to speak English. And then he asked him, why are you going there? Why are you not staying back in your African country? And the migrant went and said, well, because I don't have any job prospects in my African country, which obviously helps to once again solidify the message and the theme that actually came out of the Italy-Africa summit of 2024, where Giorgia Meloni of Italy, the Prime Minister of Italy, said at that particular summit to the AU chair, AU Commission chair, it was Mustafaki and Macky Sall were present, and William Ruto. There was a fourth African dignitary there. Those three guys were there. And the downside had been is that Meloni at the Italy-Africa forum cited specifically that Europe will try to help these North African countries and those Central African countries with industry development in order to create jobs for their own people so as to stop migration from happening to Europe. Namibia is not one of those issues. We're not, to be honest. But Namibia also faces a ticking clock. Now, if Namibia faces a ticking clock, which has been an ever-increasing loud noise I've seen in the past 6 months, is that primarily we sit with an issue of whether or not we are ever going to industrialize. I say that because you can increasingly see we are literally climbing a massive cliff. It's not a hill. It's not a slopey mountain that you can hike upwards. We are dropped down in the deep end of everything. We are told, get yourself to safety. Your safety is at the top of this cliff. If you don't know what a cliff looks like, a cliff is a rock formation which is vertical up, not gradually upwards. It's vertically up. You have no prior skills. You have no software download or patch that says you can now become a professional rock climber. Here is some dust so that your fingers stay dry, so that you can have as much grip as possible. Here's a safety rope. Here are some rock climbing shoes. Go and climb. No, we're doing this barefoot, barehanded, with no support rope. When I say that, you can technically also see potentially that there is potential, but that then the potential is not growing fast enough. The potential is not being allowed to grow fast enough. You look at that issue of Namibia's particular own growing pains, and you look at the other African countries, and you see a duplication of the same issue everywhere. Once again, exclude Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa. Exclude those three guys. They are as resilient like nothing on this continent. Just Friday's particular entertainment and media report analysis that came through from the South African PricewaterhouseCoopers entity. That report in its own right highlight one massive statistic that South Africa, that Nigeria has 107 internet users out of 232 million people. 107 million internet users. You see, businesses would kill for such statistics if they knew, oh my goodness, look at that market. We as Namibia, we are unfortunately facing a very ugly reality. We've got too few people to justify any significant market development. And even because of the too few people status, we can only implement certain kinds of market development strategies in this country. Certain kinds. I still believe, I am still of the opinion primarily, that if we have a robust development plan that is spread out over all local authorities, we can achieve a short to medium term growth trend, a very big growth trend. But that would be based upon sustainable financing and accurate project management and accurate monitoring and evaluation so as to ensure that project timeframes are met, that private sector contractors do not walk off the project sites halfway. The difference between the African Union getting to the next phase and the European Union that is just going from strength to strength to strength is that in the European context, they know that they have a shared, they have shared anchors that anchor literally the whole idea of being a bloc, operating as a single entity, and addressing major developments as a single entity. They obviously have their own democratic functions that are empowered by the treaty. For example, the Maastricht Treaty seeks to enhance the democratic functioning of institutions by conceding directly elected European Parliament rights, not only of consultation but also of co-decisions making on some categories of European legislation, because European legislation at the EU level has to flow into your national legislation if you're in a European country. Here in Namibia, our laws come from, or actually are tied into, a multitude of things. We have laws that we inherited from South Africa. There's laws that the colonial German administrations left. There are laws that exist that there's also the other, you know, the traditional laws, which are sometimes also swept under the common law brush, and incorporated into everyday lawmaking. Then we've got the EU, the UN's laws that flow into our scope. And we've got anything that at the AU Pan-African level that potentially feeds into this direction. So as you can obviously see, we're pretty much confused. We're as confused as potentially a duck that finds itself or thinks that it is probably a swan in the same scope of beauty and grace and even having a long neck for that matter. When you view these particular scenarios, you sit there with the question of, okay, so how would the alignment in an African context also work? Because the EU itself has ensured and made sure that you've got to look at all aspects of a single country, take all aspects into consideration, and then each of those aspects or those dimensions have to be addressed at a regional level so that countries can literally resonate with each of those dimensions individually, agree and cite their own uniqueness, and then come to a realization and further on agreement to say, hey, listen, we've compromised each of us on the various levels. We've considered all particular exceptions. We've incorporated those exceptions. We've highlighted specific sort of like broad-based rules and regulations and legislation that impacts but also protects, but thus also highlights specific remedies as well as also positions and regulatory authorities and authorities necessary across a European context to achieve certain particular common goals. One of those common goals is, guys, the AU level will never get to the UN, to the EU level of establishing a unified green transition project. Let me say it again. A unified Green Transition Project. Namibia is partner to that project. South Africa is partner to that project. South Africa is recently going to get, is it 12 point something billion euros for the Green Transition Development Framework. €12 billion. Guys, the AU has to move even the development bank, the AU development bank, to become an AU bank, central bank. And no African country is yet on board to say, hey, 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 wait, wait with that idea. We still have to sort certain things out. We are far off with many particular developments. We are far off with many particular sort of like provisions, common understandings, agreements, and even saying, hey, let's sit around the same fire and let's agree on some things, sort out some issues, because there's a whole bunch of issues. I still hear that supposedly M23 is still alive and kicking there in East Africa, here in East Africa. I thought the thing was disbanded. I thought that steps would be taken to disband the whole rebel group itself. I thought steps would be taken to achieve the peaceful, conducive, what's that thing's name? The peaceful, conducive state or status as agreed upon in the White House at the, in back in the first half of this year. But we still have M23 alive and kicking. So what was all the pomp and all the particular high-profile signing ceremony based upon? So we're going to take a short break, dear listeners, and after the break, we come back and we get into the last 20 minutes of this morning's program here on my Sunday Morning Take, and you're on the number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. We'll be back right after this.
Harder. desperation has a funny word. Thighs rolling forward, the demands rebirth. Desperation is a friend at hand, the reach for touch in this arid land. Oh, but you know what you do. Yeah, you and your dancing shoes. Oh, you so good at writing tomorrow. You do anything you want to. Desperation is a thing you miss. It's the asteroid, it's a final kiss. Desperation is a disconnect. The war inside for some self-respect. But you are so beautiful. Why are you and your dancing shoes? Oh, you so good at being desire. You do anything you want to. Was my sanctuary, the empire state to my sanity. Desperation is a counter strike against the giants and the rats alike. Oh, but you go through the shadows. Yeah, you and your dancing shoes. Oh, you so good at writing tomorrow. Would you take me with you? Take me with
And we come back there, dear listeners, from the sounds there of Paolo Nutini with the song Desperation. Before that, you heard a little bit of Timeless. No, that word is not correct. Sort of like the eternal, you know, Simply Red in the song The Right Thing. And that primarily brings us about 12 minutes out from the top of the hour. And where we left off was the particular indication in terms of citing, you know, the common process, the literal evolutionary processes that went into the formulation of the European Union as we know it today. Obviously, this is based upon the 1 November 1993 particular adoption or coming into effect or into force, the Maastricht Treaty that was signed on 7 February 1992, the previous year. So, that particular development obviously shows you the commitments and how things roll out. Now, you can obviously see this particular sort of like setting down time frames and timelines and developments and goals and objectives and responsibilities and obligations is something that we are technically exposed to right now. But before I continue, I see there's a caller coming through. Let's have a listen. Eagle FM, good morning.
Yes, great.
How are you doing, Uncle Bona?
Cool, man. Good morning.
Morning. Uncle Bona, was it you trying to come through earlier? Because I saw the phone line flashing.
Yeah, that time when you were talking about the Traoré, whatever this was for autocratic leaders.
Yeah. Traoré.
We are taking the power by force.
Yeah.
And they are being appreciated by many, many, especially here.
Yeah.
So people are so happy that they forced their way to take the overthrow the elected government.
Yep.
And people are saying, yes, it's good, what, and things like that.
And then they complain when he dissolves the Electoral Commission. Then they complain when he dissolves. Angabana, do you see literally the how bad military leaders are? Because literally they just try to consolidate their own position, and they will, and they don't want to hand over power.
They don't want to hand over power. So at least in the democratic dispensation like this, where people are elected and the people have got voice and the matter,
yeah.
I think it's a good thing for us.
Yes, it is.
So it's a good thing for us.
I mean, the only thing we have to deal with is trying to sort out how, you know, corruption does not become a perpetual evil for our economy. That's it.
That's the only thing.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. I think we need just to help our people to understand the value of democracy and those military rules and things like that. All these countries, like you mentioned, Nigerians and many others have tested these things. And the things become more corrupt, actually. So, the France yesterday was also hinting on some of those issues. But we really need to value our own democracy.
Yeah.
Our own rules and things like that too. So that we don't end up in trouble. Because we might end up in trouble and then start complaining and things will become more worse. And people will be shot, not just military and all these people. You don't care, sometimes they just shoot. If you see people dying in many other countries there. Of course, democracy, maybe it has got its own weakness, but it cannot be compared to this the military rule.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much. But our own, I think we should also create our own bloc. Like those people that created theirs long time ago, and they are common, all those 17 that you have mentioned. So, Dwight, thank you very much, my brother. God bless.
Not a problem. Thanks, Angabona. So, in terms of just quickly answering one question, dear listeners, SADC is actually on track a lot quicker than AU of achieving integration. SADC in its own right is on track a lot quicker to achieving integration, regional integration, than AU integration, which is continental. SADC has proven itself to be more stable. Yes, we've got the hotspots of Cabo Delgado in Mozambique, and now obviously also Madagascar is now a little bit of a blight on our reputation as being a very, very peaceful, very stable part of the African continent. This particular community of Southern African states. But you know what? We are still... Oh, yes, and Eastern DRC is also another particular blight because that has been coming on now for more than 10 years. But still, we still prove this particular unique, stable environment in Southern Africa, which many parts of the continent itself is struggling with still. They either jump or fall into dictatorships or fall into authoritarian platforms and discussions. Not to say that Europe does not have it, because it seems like there's a whole bunch of accusations being thrown about there in Europe regarding who is authoritarian and who is not, who is corrupt and who is not, who knows what they're doing and who does not know what they're doing. Yeah, I observe those things as well, because you sometimes need to understand who are the guys that are literally helping Namibia and SADC achieve some sort of a developmental, positive developmental trend scenario. You have to go look at the EU guys and go like, okay, what's going on in your country? What are you guys doing? Are you guys all good over there? But as I say that particular statement, obviously, much of the particular things also has highlighted that there were certain things that just did not sit so good with the European project. Obviously, Brexit is the biggest indicator of that, where the British thought that they could still sort of like chart their own particular course in terms of determining their own particular futures, but their leaders had signed on in 1992. They'd signed on in 1993, and they had signed on to various particular legal instruments as well. For example, there was a few things that the United Kingdom was not party to, for example, in terms of maintaining the integrity of their own currency. The British did not sign on to the part of the agreement, the Maastricht Agreement, with respect to the obligation to enter the final single currency and single currency stage of a monetary union, because the UK would not have to give up its pound sterling, that's the name of its currency. The British also were not party to the agreement on social policy and secured to an opt-out from that part of the agreement, which was a protocol of it. So you obviously had these particular things, you know, being in play, as well as also the singular participatory sort of like aspects of each of the member states. And in what particular characteristics they obviously, you know, joined. There were obviously a whole bunch of things that obviously took place, because there was a whole bunch of voting that had to be conducted, in many cases, because firstly they had to go and have referendums in each of the signing countries, that obviously signed on to the treaty itself, so as to see, you know, what's the level of adoption, what's the level of agreement to the spirit of the treaty in its entirety, and whether or not these countries were ready to take the next step towards singular, you know, towards becoming a single entity, a single legal entity itself. I had to also, let me also at this moment in time, dear listeners, sort of like correct one thing that I also, I stated incorrectly as well. And this was on previous sessions, where I literally said the EU does not have a UN member state. They actually do have a UN member state, status. They are a UN member, specifically the EU. It's not that they are not. They literally do have such a position. They have an ambassador in there. That ambassador is also the same ambassador that sits at the Security Council level as one of the observatory members. You get like your five fixed members, and then there are like the five sort of like temporary members. The EU is always a temporary member, and temporary members are always like in an they always sit there as an, or attend as an observation status. Those temporary guys, because the main guys who propose things and talk about things are the five permanent members. Another country or representative that is also, you know, a permanent temporary fixture is Japan. You also have South Korea there. And in very few cases, individual African country, but the AU also is there. But I don't know if the AU has the same status as the EU as a full-on UN member. However, we obviously know that all AU members are UN members. So you sit with those particular indications, and obviously you get an understanding of what that looks like. Now that does bring us up to the end of our discussion, dear listeners, for this morning's session. We're about 2 minutes out from the top of the hour. We step into another musical break. After that, we'll say our goodbyes, and you can stay on then further after that for the rest of your programming here in our company, here in the number one talk radio station, this being Eagle FM.
I'm always wondering what it would be like to die. She asks me why. I always smile when I feel like I'm gonna cry. She asks me why. Over the cliff in phantom sands, she's always offering me her hand. And I hear her coming through the echoes, through the echoes, through the echoes, straight to me. Over and over, over and over, over and over again.
imagine what it would feel like to fly. I ask her why. She says everything that she sees shines in the sky. Up there shining. When your belly's wrong, you go down the phone. When you ask for bread, you get a stone. When you feel like you're alone, listen for me coming. Through the echo, through the echo.
Coming back there from the sounds specifically of the Black Keys. Before that, you had a little bit of Paolo Nutini with Through the Echoes. And it does bring us up to the end of this morning's discussion here on my Sunday Morning Take. And obviously, this has sort of like lent us into a new understanding specifically of one of our largest development partners, and specifically the role that they take and have taken specifically to achieve their particular goals and how they set it out in terms of doing so. Now, on that note, dear listeners, we'll see each other again during the course of this week on the home run, and as well as also on certain days of the early morning scoop. Alternatively, you can catch me next week, same time, same place here on my Sunday Morning Take from 5 to 7, and enjoy the rest of your programming in our company during the course of this Sunday. On that note, do enjoy the first Sunday of November. Hope you've got at least have had a cup of coffee. And if you're driving somewhere, be safe, as well as also try to remember to adhere to the road rules. On that note, enjoy the rest of your Sunday in our company.